But demands of discipleship, and we looked at Luke chapter 9 at a few verses, and then we came to Luke 14. And can I remind you about some of the requirements that we have already looked at, that there are requirements for following Jesus, and these are requirements that Jesus himself has set forth. And they are not optional. One of the things that just is grating on me, especially in recent years, I understand we live in a culture that is not Christian. And I expect pagans to live and act and think like pagans. But what I find particularly galling, to be candid with you, is that when people try to suggest that they have the definition to Christianity and they actually redefine it, and there are people who are in positions of political power and other civic and public leaders and well-known people who start talking about what is Christian and what isn't. And it's not according to what the New Testament is teaching. It's according to their own creation of what they've decided Christianity is. We don't have that as an option. We cannot redefine what it means to be a Christian. And we certainly can't dismiss the demands of discipleship that Jesus himself has set forth. For example, back in Luke 9, we looked at the fact that he said anyone who would be his disciple must renounce himself. He must bear his cross. He must be following Jesus not just as an onlooker, but as an obedient learner. Following Jesus means, if necessary, forsaking family ties. Remember the hyperbole, you must hate your mother and father in order to follow me. And then lastly, we were looking at this matter of relinquishing material possessions. And so let's just reread some of the verses that we've already looked at and then add some additional thoughts here today from Luke 14. I'll begin reading at verse 25. Now the great multitudes were going along with him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, when he sets out," I might pause there at verse 30. Just think of the corner of University Avenue and 13th Street. But I read on. Verse 31. "Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and take counsel whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks terms of peace. So therefore, no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all his own possessions." Now, a month ago, but I want to repeat just a bit of it because I know it's been a while since we looked at this, and maybe some of you were not with us when we dealt with this last statement back in the earlier part of June. We looked at what Jesus does mean, and that is we have to be unattached to material possessions to the point that if God requires it of us, we're willing to let them go. You have to be willing to give up all your possessions if Jesus asks us to do that. But I also made the point that Jesus does not always ask his followers to give up all their possessions. And I wanted to spend a little more time on this so that you have a firm grasp of what this requirement of discipleship looks like. Now, I said a person must be willing to do that, but it's obvious that Jesus does not always require it. And I want to just show you a few other texts that lead me to this conclusion. We all know the story of the rich young ruler in Luke chapter 18. A young man came to Jesus, said, "What must I do?" And Jesus laid down the requirement to give up all that you have. And the man went away downcast because he was very wealthy. And he obviously wasn't ready to step up and respond to the call Jesus had placed on his life. But I believe that it is clear that Jesus asked that and required that of that young man because Jesus knew the one thing that stood between that young man's heart and having a genuine relationship of obedience to God. Look at Luke chapter 19. If you flip over just a couple of chapters, Luke 19, verse 8, and Zacchaeus stopped and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, half of my possessions I will give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will give back four times as much." And Jesus said to him, now he didn't say, well, half's not good enough. You've got to give up everything you own. No, Jesus said to him, verse 9, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." And so here you have Jesus saying two different things to two different people. To the rich young ruler, he required that he give up everything. Here Zacchaeus offers to give up half of everything and repay fourfold people he's ripped off, and Jesus pronounces a blessing on him. Over in Matthew chapter 27, Matthew 27, verse 57. "And when it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus." Now this is the very same one who helped to have Jesus buried immediately after he died on the cross. But he is described as a disciple of Jesus, and he's also described as one who was rich. And Luke, he adds the comment about this Joseph of Arimathea that he was a good and righteous man. So obviously he was a rich man who Jesus did not demand that he relinquish his wealth. In Luke chapter 14, to go back to that chapter, earlier in the chapter, starting in verse 12, "And he also went on to say to the one who had invited him, 'When you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and repayment come to you. But when you give a reception, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, since they do not have the means to repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous.'" Again, addressing people of means and not saying to them they needed to relinquish their wealth and their possessions, but rather use it in a way that they're looking out for the needs of the disadvantaged. We take examples such as these I've just read to you, and we add to it the testimony of church history. There is just not evidence that as the church grew, the early church, that all believers gave up all their possessions. In fact, God used the means of certain individuals who were people of wealth to propagate the gospel. Lydia of Thyatira was apparently a successful businesswoman, and she provided a place for Paul to stay. Jason of Thessalonica. You have Aquila and Priscilla in Corinth, who had a home there as well as one in Ephesus and actually hosted a house church. Titus Justus, he happened to have the home next door to the synagogue where Paul set up shop and taught out of his house for a year and a half. It was good Titus Justus had a big enough house for a bunch of people to get in and for the gospel to be taught. I think where the misunderstanding potentially creeps in is when we read, as we did when our congregation studied the book of Acts a year or two ago, in Acts chapter 2, we see this description of the early church in verse 44, "And all those who had believed were together and had all things in common. Acts chapter 4, verse 32, and the congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and not one of them claimed that anything belonging to him was his own, but all things were common property to them. As we look at the occasion here in Acts and then see as the church developed, that this kind of communal sharing was voluntary. It was not commanded, and it was not the general practice unendingly, but rather responded to a specific need. And you will recall that a famine ended up hitting Jerusalem, and Christians were being persecuted, and it became all the more necessary in that crisis for people to come together. And even Ananias and Sapphira, who somewhat hypocritically sold property and claimed that they had given the proceeds over to the church when they'd really held back some, and as they're being confronted with that lie, and before they're struck dead for lying against the Spirit of God, it says that was the property not your own? In other words, they weren't even required to sell it. But once they did, you know, why'd they have to lie about it? I think I'm right in saying that Luke, more than any other gospel writer, has more information about material possessions and money than any of the other three gospel writers. And the emphasis that Luke seems to record of Jesus' teaching really addresses more the attitude of having possessions. And I also believe, in my study of Luke, that Jesus had a particular audience in mind when he did give an exhortation, a teaching, and an admonition about possessions. And I want to demonstrate this to you, because each and every time Jesus addresses the matter of possessions, if you look just a few verses before or a very few verses after, you will find that he has a particular audience in mind, and it is these corrupt Jewish leaders. It'll just take a moment. We mentioned the rich young ruler. Turn to Luke chapter 18. Verse 18, and a certain ruler questioned him, saying, "Good teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus said to him, "Why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone." And then he quotes the commandments. He says, "I've obeyed these from my youth." And then Jesus says, "One thing, verse 22, you still lack. Sell all you possess and distribute it to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." And when he heard these things, he became very sad, for he was extremely rich. So Luke records, when Jesus has that exchange with this rich young ruler, if you look back up at verses 9 to 14 of this same chapter, it's Pharisees and tax gatherers in verses 9 to 14 that he is concerned about. He also told this parable to certain ones who trusted in themselves, and they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. That's what he says in verse 9. So he's concerned about these contemptible, wealthy people, and then right on the heels of it has the story of the rich young ruler. We all know the story of the poor widow. Go to Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21. One of those little touching vignettes in the Gospels. Verse 1, and he looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw a certain poor widow putting in two small copper coins. And he said, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all of them, for they all out of their surplus put into the offering, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on." Prior to that instance, in Luke chapter 20, verse 1, and it came about on one of the days while he was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, that the chief priests and the scribes and the elders confronted him. And then if you drop down to verses 46 and 47 of that same Luke 20, Jesus says, because if the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and love respectful greetings in the marketplaces and chief seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets, who devour widows' houses and for appearance sake offer long prayers, these will receive greater condemnation. And so right on the heels of that, we have the instance recorded of the widow giving her small amount, which was truly, in God's sight, a great amount. So my point is just simply this, that as these teachings are given forth, there's not any one pattern that God intends for every single Christian to follow identically. And beyond even material possessions, we all have things in our lives that we try to hold on to. And you can be sure that God does accept us the way we are, but he loves us too much to leave us that way. And if there's anything that we're hanging on to that supplants Jesus being the supreme affection and priority and goal of our lives, that the Spirit is going to convict us and work on prying our fingers loose from whatever it is that we would consider more important than him. So on this, when he says one cannot be my disciple unless he sells all of his possessions, that needs to be the disposition that, yes, I'm ready to do that which he calls me to do. There are risks that come with having material possessions, but there are not only risks, there are responsibilities. In Matthew chapter 6, many of you know this verse, it'll be up on the screen. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Let me remind you of this familiar parable from Luke chapter 12. Jesus says, and he told them a parable, saying, the land of a certain rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? And he said, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. So there's risks of having possessions. One, that we begin to serve money, which means we can't serve God. We become presumptuous about our standard of living and the things we're able to acquire, not taking into account mortality, not knowing, as James says, our life is but a vapor. We don't know what our life's going to be like tomorrow. That's not a call to not prepare and to try and be ready for the future, but it has to do with where we're putting our sense of security. And 1 Timothy chapter 6, if you would turn there, Paul sets forth some other risks of possessions. Verse 7, for we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. And if we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a pang. And so we won't dig into it in a lot of detail, but if we just look at verses 6 to 10, what is it that Paul is telling us about the risks of possessions? Well, for one, riches do not provide contentment. Also, riches are only temporal. Another risk of possessions is that they distort in our minds the distinction between necessities and luxuries. Henry David Thoreau, who was a poet, philosopher, was a civilly disobedient man when it came to paying taxes. There's a lot of things he had to say that I didn't agree with, but I thought he was on target when he said this: a man is wealthy in proportion to the number of things he can afford to do without. And as Paul tells us here, that not only does it distort necessities from luxuries, but the love of riches and money leads us into sin. In fact, the way he says it here, all sorts of evils. In the Greek, it's actually plural, not just all sorts of evil, but all sorts of evils. And I'm not telling you something you don't already know. The sin includes the wrong ways of acquiring material possessions, whether it be cheating or lying or stealing or killing. It breeds selfishness. It corrupts one's priorities. Would you hand me your bulletin card for a minute? If you look at the bottom of the outline there, I've got a quote by Charles Spurgeon. I forgot to bring mine up with me. But that's what prompted the famous British Baptist preacher to say, "I am never afraid for my brethren who have many troubles, but I often tremble for those whose career is prosperous." And also there is the risk of possessions of corrupting our priorities. Well, I just went to see recently the movie Jersey Boys. That's the music I grew up with in the 50s and the 60s. And, of course, the lead singer for the Four Seasons, Frankie Valli, is kind of the central figure in the movie. And Frankie Valli, just in the last few years, has been divorced from his third wife. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised. Often the entertainment industry in Hollywood does quite a number on long-term marriages. They don't happen very much. But when he was being interviewed, once the divorce from his third wife of 22 years was finalized, he said this: "If you're in show business, your partner has to understand they'll always come second. Success requires your work must come first." He went on to say, "Second doesn't mean you don't have a great love for this person, but she has to accept the long absences and she'll be raising the children and so on. I wouldn't give up show business for anybody." Well, he's been true to his word. He's had three divorces. Why? Because he has made that drastic mistake of thinking that his career was more important than his spouse. If you drop down to verse 17 of 1 Timothy 6, he says something else. "Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy." When people amass money, there is the risk. It doesn't mean it always happens, but there is, I'm talking about risks here. There is the risk of becoming deceptively self-sufficient. And then also it breeds a certain kind of pride and conceit where often people with a lot of money look down on people who don't have money. There's a certain snobbishness that can accompany acquiring great wealth. A few months ago, my wife and I were staying at a hotel down in West Palm Beach. And my son used to work there in the area. I don't know if you've ever been to Palm Beach Island. But Palm Beach Island has been dubbed, they looked at the top 10 in the country, it is the richest zip code in America. We're not talking about millionaires, we're talking about billionaires. And I don't know about you, but I can sometimes have I can kind of visualize a million, but you know, a billion. Well, this is the difference between $1 million and $1 billion. If somebody gave you $1 million and $1,000 bills, and they really don't print those anymore, but when they used to print them, if someone gave you $1 million in $1,000 bills and you stacked them on your dining room table, it would make a stack of about 8 to 10 inches high. If somebody gave you $1 billion made up of $1,000 bills and you put them on a stack, you'd need to go outside, because it would make a stack 115 feet higher than the Washington Monument, which is 555 feet. That's the difference between $1 billion and $1 million. Well, the richest zip code in America is right here in our state, in Palm Beach Island. I was reading one of those books they usually have in the hotels to tell you about the area, things to see. And one of the famous shopping districts in Palm Beach Island is Worth Avenue. I've walked down it. This was the promotion they had in their tourism book, sitting on the desk in the hotel. I was so struck by it, I went downstairs and Xeroxed it. I'm going to read you this little brief paragraph. Worth Avenue, psst, come closer. We don't want to raise our voice. We're not supposed to tell you this, but there's shopping in Palm Beach, and anyone can go. We're whispering because the tiny town of Palm Beach is very sensitive about unwanted traffic. The Starbucks and Neiman Marcus stores barely got permission to open on Worth Avenue. Don't want to attract the wrong element. Even so, there's plenty of high-end shopping here, including Saks Fifth Avenue, Tiffany & Company, Gucci, Cartier, Brooks Brothers. No riffraff, please. It actually says this. No riffraff, please. That's someone who has become full of themselves. It's one of the risks of wealth. You've heard this new, in fact, it was made famous by a trial just this last December. Remember the trial of the young man, the teenager, who was not sent to prison for life because of affluenza? Did you all see that? Few of you did. Well, you need to know about this. I mean, it's incredible. A book came out just a few years ago. It was called Affluenza, the All-Consuming Epidemic. And what they've done is they've taken the disease influenza and the word affluence, and they've created this term affluenza. And it's defined as a painful, contagious, socially transmitted condition of overload, debt, anxiety, and waste resulting from the dogged pursuit of more. But the term affluenza has also been used to refer to the inability to understand the consequences of one's actions because of financial privilege. And thus, this Texas teenager apparently stole beer. Witnesses saw this. A surveillance video confirmed it. He stole beer from a store. He also took his father's Ford F-350 without telling him, was going 70 miles an hour in a 40-mile zone. He had a blood alcohol level 3 times the legal limit 3 hours after the accident is what it registered. And he proceeded in his drunk driving state to kill 4 pedestrians and injure 11 others. And yet he was given 10 years probation for drunk driving. And they said he was suffering from affluenza. He was unable to understand the consequences of his actions because of his financial privilege, and he needed rehabilitation and not prison. So Paul, he wrote it 2,000 years ago, but it's just as true today. But those are some of the risks. But there's also tremendous responsibilities of possessions. John the Baptist gave this reply to some questions he was asked on one occasion in Luke chapter 3. The verse will be here on the screen. Luke chapter 3, verses 11 to 14. He is John the Baptist. He would answer and say to them, "The man who has two tunics is to share with him who has none, and he who has food is to do likewise." And some tax collectors also came to be baptized, and they said to him, "Teacher, what shall we do?" And he said to them, "Collect no more than what you have been ordered to." Some soldiers were questioning him, saying, "And what about us? What shall we do?" And he said to them, "Do not take money from anyone by force or accuse anyone falsely, and be content with your wages." And so John the Baptist, even in that brief interchange, is addressing attitudes of one's possessions and not taking advantage and extorting from other people, but also having a spirit of graciousness and sharing. The Apostle Paul, in much the same way in Ephesians 4, 28, "He who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with one who has need." I read 1 Timothy 6:17, but let's add verses 18 and 19 to it. "Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed." And so the "instruct them" of verses 18 and 19 are the rich that he's mentioned in verse 17 that we read a moment ago. Then in 1 John 3:17, "Whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him?" So yes, God allows some to have tremendous amounts of material possessions. But there's privilege and responsibility that comes with that. And it's called a spirit of generosity. It is a spirit of sharing. As Jesus said in another place, there is participating in the advancing of the kingdom of God and using one's resources to do that. At the end of the service today, we'll be singing one of Martin Luther's songs, the great German reformer. But I love this statement that he once wrote, that for a Christian, three conversions are necessary. First, the conversion of the heart, then the conversion of the mind, then the conversion of the purse. And I don't know that since the early 1500s, that really needs to be changed. So the demands of discipleship. It's easier to say it than to do it. But I hope that you, like me, are constantly evaluating, assessing, looking at what God has allowed me to have, and constantly before the Lord thinking, how should I deal with that which you've allowed me to have, whether it be great or little. Certainly the risks of possessions does not only pertain to the rich. There is the lack of possessions and money that often is a risk for people because of their either resentment or their coveting or basically just not trusting God and being content. As Paul said, we'll be content with food and clothing. Now, I'll be the first to admit, Lord, can I just add AC? I'll be content with food and clothing and air conditioning, especially in Florida in the summer. And so I'm not above these things. There are creature comforts that I have just like you do. But what will we do and what will be our attitude if the time comes when we don't have them? There's a lot of doomsayers out there telling us that it's all going to come crashing down here eventually. But even if it does, we still have the Holy Spirit. And we still have our relationship to God, who is the anchor.